You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast featuring some of Indiana's most fascinating men and women whose impact has shaped our state, our communities, and us. Join us as we discuss their imprint on our history. Leaders and Legends is brought to you by Veteran Strategies Incorporated, your local veteran business enterprise specializing in public relations, media relations, public outreach, crisis communications, and digital photography. My name is Robert Bain, Principal of Veteran Strategies, former Deputy Chief of Staff to Mayor Greg Ballard, and Communications Director for the Indiana Republican Party. I'm honored to be your host for our discussion. Today on Leaders and Legends, sponsored by Veteran Strategies, we have two very distinguished, very well-liked public servants. Former Democrat State Senator Louis Mahern from Indianapolis, and also we have former Lieutenant Governor, former state senator and former state rep, I believe, John Mutz. They're longtime friends. They've gone around and I believe more than once talked to audiences about bipartisanship and the need to work together. And they really have been present at the creation when it comes to modern Indianapolis and seeing this city and state grow. Lieutenant Governor Mutz, thank you for being here.
My pleasure, Rob. Senator Mahern, to be with Louis.
Yeah. Thank you for being here. Thank you very much for being here. Let's start at the beginning. Do you remember kind of when you first met?
You know, I don't remember the exact moment, but Louis joined the U.S. or the Senate. I'm going clear off the subject here. And I was already there, I believe, if that's not true. And we became friends as we found we had mutual interests in issues. That's really how it started for us, I think.
And you... Senator Mahern, you joined in 76 is when you were elected to the state senate.
I was elected in 76, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which part of Indianapolis did you two respectively represent?
I represented the Near East Side, the East Side of Center Township.
And I represented what you would describe as the far northeast part of the county, part of the Lawrence Township, and part of it was inside the old city boundary.
It mentioned ideas or issues you had in common. Talk, maybe, Louis Mahern, talk a little bit about what those issues were, what you found to be in common.
Well, I tell you, and John doesn't remember this, after I had been in the Senate for a couple of weeks, and I just kind of laid back, and my seat, since I was a freshman, my seat was way in the back. And so I had a very good view of everything that was going on. And after a couple of weeks, you know, I decided that I need to have a friend. And I should preface this by saying that I was a congressional staffer for 8 years before I was elected to the Senate. So I was incredibly fortunate to have that kind of legislative training as to how legislative bodies work. And I knew that, you know, the Democrats were in the majority. I knew that we weren't going to be in the majority forever. We might only be in the majority for 2 years, given Indiana and its conservative ways. So I decided I need to form a relationship with somebody on the other side who I can do business with. And so I laid back for a couple of weeks, and I came to the conclusion that John Mutz is he's a very bright guy, he's an articulate guy, and he's not crazy, you know? And so
I feel that's a compliment. Yeah. Right now. Yeah.
We almost named the podcast that.
Yeah. And so I went up to him one time on the floor and said, you know, can you have lunch sometime? So we went over to the press club. And I told him that I had a list of the bills that I had introduced. And I told him, I said, if there are any bills on here on this list that you're interested in putting your name on, let me know and I'll put your name on it. And if you have any bills that you think I might be interested in, let me know. And we agreed to do that.
Was it hard to find someone to work with back then?
No, really? I don't. It wasn't, and actually, it pretty much came down to a question of which Marion County Republican am I going to approach, because Morris Mills and Larry Borst were pretty simpatico, and pretty open-minded, and so John was a little younger than they. And
so when John Mutz became lieutenant governor in 1980, along with Governor Bob Orr, did you feel like you had bet on the right horse? Like, man, I'm pretty smart here. I chose the right guy back in 76.
Well, no, I didn't think about that. But I enjoyed working with John. I enjoyed working with Bob Orr. There were some issues that I worked very closely with the Orr administration on, particularly having to do with educational reform.
Lieutenant Governor Mutz, is there a better, you hear a lot from folks who've been involved in politics for decades, and by decades I mean 40, 50, 60 years, that sort of thing, that it was different back then. They don't always quantify what back then is or identify, but this politics was different back then, relationships were different back then. Is that a statement with which you would agree, or just say, look, politics has always been a blood sport, sometimes best, sometimes not?
I would agree that there was a difference in the kind of environment that we operated in. And I would also say that there were also some times when some vicious events occurred. But, I mean, if you go back and look at the time of Lincoln and the stuff that they wrote and said about him, he was accused of having come from the monkeys of a zoo and all kinds of
weird
stuff.
They called him the original
stuff.
Gorilla.
That's right. And you look at the Ford Theater as an exhibit in the basement of the Ford Theater, Washington, D.C., that describes what the press said about him. So the vicious nature of politics has been there for a long time.
What they said about Andrew Jackson when he ran in the 1820s.
Yeah, but the difference, I'd say, is that when I got elected to the legislature, I was part of a political movement, and we like to describe that as the Action Committee moment in terms of Republican politics. And our goal was to take over the Republican Party from the old-time leadership, and the old-time leadership was represented by County Chairman Dale Brown.
Right.
Dale Brown was a veteran of the political patronage system. He got to the point in his career in which it was more important to keep his job and the patronage than it was to elect Republicans to office.
So when were you first elected to the Indiana House? Was it part of the 66? Was it the Bulin class? 66?
Yes, it was. Uh-huh. And so I was a member of 15 who were elected in the Action Committee year. And among those are a number of people, well, not many left now, but Ray Crow, for example, the basketball coach from Crispus Attucks.
Another name I can throw out there, which is and something that he was given or earned, which is shocking, is Richard Guthrie. Richard Guthrie was part of the class of 66.
That's right.
His daughter, Jennifer, and I graduated from Howe High School together. Mm-hmm. But he was elected in 1966, a freshman, became Speaker of the House as a freshman. Mm-hmm. Now, that's unheard of these days.
Yeah, that's before my time. I knew Dick Guthrie very well, but he was not part of the 15.
Okay, good.
Yeah. And the point I want to make is that when we first got elected, we had a whole lot of things we wanted to do. We had a specific agenda, and we decided, well, Marion County is always the enemy of the rest of the state. You know, Indianapolis, quote, gets everything.
Sure.
So we need to do something about that. So we started out with the intention of making friends out in the state, and we started with other Republicans. It was an overwhelming Republican year when we won, big majority, and so there were a lot of people who were new, just like we were. Now, not everybody was new, but nearly everybody. And so we actually assigned specific legislators out in the state, and we called on them. And I remember one of the people that I was assigned was in Bloomington, Indiana. And I remember going down and talking to him, and I said, well, what do you want out of the legislature? He says, just one thing. I want a road, a four-lane road between Bloomington and Indianapolis so people can get to the ball games. And I said, well, you know, that would require a tax increase, a gasoline tax increase. He said, oh, I know it. I'm with you. we'll work on that together. Well, that was an example of the kind of relationships that we tried to set up. This gentleman later became chairman of the board of Cook Inc. in Bloomington. And so I guess what I'm saying is that we went out with the idea of making friends. Now, did we intentionally make friends with Democrats? Not to start with, but this event that Louis describes here, which I admit, I do not remember the specifics of it, but I do remember session after session and moment after moment, Louis and I traded comments and ideas. And we did this around a lot of things. And, you know, for example, one of the things we co-sponsored was an increase in AFDC payments. Now,
aid for dependent children.
That's right. And the increase we advocated was like $20 a week or something like that. But it wasn't a lot of money. But Louis and I talked privately, and we said, this is unreasonable. We can't expect anybody to exist on this kind of money. Well, my Republican colleagues thought I had left the church. You know, it was one of those situations in which, well, why would you get together with a Democrat on that? I said, because it's the right thing to do. And so we did things like that back and forth. The White River State Park, I can name a whole lot of other things, but those are samples of things.
You mentioned, and then I want to ask Louis about his time in D.C. because he worked with two real titans of Indiana politics, Indiana public servants. What was your impression of Bulin? I mean, that book came out with him that all of us political nerds read.
Yeah.
What did you think of his skill, of his vision?
Well, I'd have to start by saying that the Action Committee was not originally Bulin. It was a group of Republican office holders who had decided Dale Brown was no longer the right person to lead the party. Circuit Judge John Niblack, Noble Piercy, the prosecutor, the assessor, John Sutton was the auditor or treasurer. The point I make is, and one of them was Marcia Hawthorne. Now, Marcia Hawthorne was my mother-in-law. She passed away quite some time ago. And Marcia had been in politics as a ward chairman and all that stuff for years. She ran a license branch under the old license branch system. And she got the license branch from Dale Brown. I mean, the county chairman passed those franchises out. So I, of course, talked to Marcia a lot about this. But what happened was these office holders got together and said, we got to do something that's better. Then they decide, well, who should lead the effort? And there were several names that were thrown around. But Keith really wanted to do it. He knew about it. He wasn't a member of the original group of office holders,
Okay. Although
he had been a legislator 4 years before that. And so they decided Bulin was the guy to lead the charge. And I remember my mother-in-law saying, oh, Keith's good looking. He's a great dresser. The women will love him. I remember her saying, she said that to me. And I said, well, that isn't exactly the attributes that I see in Marcia, but you know, it's one of those things. So the result was that they picked Bulin to run that campaign, and the campaign was a grassroots campaign in which we elected 200-plus new precinct committeemen who we got in office for the sole purpose of throwing Dale Brown out. That was the approach.
Did the success, the continued success of the Marion County Republican Party late 60s, 70s, 80s, through the 90s until Bart Peterson wins in 1999. Did that surprise you, or is that just UNIGOV-driven, good candidates, great mayoral leaders?
Well, you have to understand that there was, first of all, in Bulin's approach to things, he said the first thing to do is to elect good people to office. The second thing is support them in what they do, and if they do things that are not good for the image of the party, get rid of them. I mean, that was his basic approach. He also was someone who said, our job is not to turn out a big vote. He says, you know, when you go to a precinct and the committeeman brags how many people have voted, that isn't what you ask. You ask how many Republicans that voted for our slate have voted. That's the key question. Keith was an advocate of the old Lincoln philosophy. He says, make a list of all the voters, determine who are for you and against you, get your people to the polls, and don't worry about any of the others. And that's allegedly attributed to Lincoln.
Louis, you had mentioned and alluded to earlier your previous career before you became a state senator. You worked for really what are two of the most impactful and influential public servants in at least modern Indiana history, certainly the 20th century. Tell us a little bit about your time with Senator Bai and Representative Jacobs.
I spent 5 years on the Hill and 3 years back here. I spent a year working for Andy in Indianapolis, and then and went out to D.C. with him in January '69. He lost to Hudnut in 72, and so 73 I went on the other side of the Capitol building and went to work for Birch Bayh for a year in Washington, and then for a couple of years back here before I left to run for the Senate. They were both, you know, politics is not without its temperamental people, and but neither one of these guys was ever that way. Neither one of them were anything but kind to their staff, understanding of their staff. You know, when you had to like work extra hours or you had to come back to Indiana for a week for something or other, you know, Birch would call my wife and tell her how important it was that I came back here and thank her for, you know, the support and that sort of thing. And I never saw either one of them ever lose their temper. You know, I used to tell people that, you know, there's an old saying that no man is a hero to his own valet. And I saw both of these guys up close and personal under sometimes trying circumstances, and I never saw them lose their temper.
Birch Bayh lost to Dan Quayle in 1980.
That's right.
It was probably the biggest political upset in Indiana history until 2007 when Ballard beat Bart Peterson. I only bring that up because it's so long ago. It's 38 years ago, almost 39 years ago. Do you get the sense that Birch Bayh's accomplishments, not only to Indiana in the Senate, but the country as a whole, are undervalued? Like, we don't appreciate enough what Birch Bayh did?
Well, first of all, I would say that if you look at the vote totals, Birch's loss to Dan Quayle was not so much of an upset as it was a wave election.
Certainly, in 1980, the Republicans did well everywhere, including for Mr. Mutz.
Well, and Ronald Reagan, you know, ran extremely well in Indiana, right. and Birch ran, I believe, a couple of 100,000 votes ahead of the rest of the ticket. But it was just, the wave was just too much for him. I think for the common person in Indiana, there's not that much understanding about what Birch Bayh did. I mean, you know, there's people talk about the FISA court. He was the author of the FISA court. He was the author of two constitutional amendments.
Presidential succession. Go ahead,
and the 18-year-old vote. He was the author of the Juvenile Justice Act. I mean, this guy was...
Was it the ERA as well, as my memory serving?
Yes, yeah.
Which was never passed, but was certainly a hot topic in the 70s and 80s.
It passed the U.S. Congress, and it fell two or three states short of ratification ratification. But let me add to that I think that it's just a matter of public memory. I think that you know, Dick Lugar, who I consider to be you know, one of the great senators from the state of Indiana. I think it's amazing that I consider two of the greatest senators Indiana's ever had both served simultaneously. But already I believe that if you ask people, you know, tell me about Dick Lugar and what Dick Lugar had accomplished and all that sort of thing, people would be hard pressed because, you know,
I worked on Senator Lugar. He's not my friend. So he's not my buddy. He's an acquaintance, Senator Lugar, Super PAC in 2012. And while I certainly believe that it could be said that the Lugar machine, lost touch with Indiana politics at the grassroots level. I think that's almost irrefutable. When people would say, well, what has he done lately? You just wanted to look at them. I'm like, do you have any idea what this man does for this state day in and day out, the credibility that he gives Indiana just by his mere presence? And truly that was Birch Bayh before that was Richard Lugar. I mean, Bayh, I think, was elected the first time in 62.
Yeah.
And then he beats Lugar in 74 in a close election. Mm-hmm. Were you involved with that at all? The 74 election?
I was on the staff, when that happened, yeah.
I mean, you get two titans going up against each other like that.
Well, it was a good year for the Democrats.
Right, the Watergate year.
As a matter of fact, Birch was elected three times, and that was the only good year for Democrats in which he ran. But, I mean, you talk about Dick Lugar's service. I don't think, and not just to Indiana, but to the country, I believe there's very little understanding about the service that Dick Lugar did in nuclear disarmament.
Exactly.
And when the Soviet Union fell apart, there were atomic or nuclear weapons all over the Soviet Union, not just in Russia, but all over the Soviet Union. And it would have been very easy for those things to have fallen into the wrong hands. And he and Sam Nunn did a tremendous service for the world in that regard.
And I don't, correct me if I'm wrong, neither one received the Nobel Peace Prize, which is shocking. They were nominated, yeah. Did you, and I want to talk about Andy Jacobs here for just one second, because he's someone I got to know pretty well. He was incredibly kind and gracious to me, because as a history nut, I mean, he was a walking, like, let me ask you about this, or let me tell you about this. And I'll tell this very quick story because I want to hear more from you two. But I went to a fundraiser, was invited to a fundraiser for Richard Lugar in 2012. So a very tough year, a primary year in which he lost to Murdoch. On the way to the fundraiser, I went to Andy Jacobs' house over there on the west side, kind of by the art museum. And he says, well, what are you going to do? We talked Civil War history and talked this or that for about an hour with these gigantic Great Danes. Holy mackerel, he had the biggest. They were like horses. He says, what are you doing after this? I said, actually, I'm going to a fundraiser for Dick Lugar, for Senator Lugar. He's in a tough fight, you know. Andy, who, if he wasn't bedridden, was pretty close at that time, reached in his bedside drawer, pulled out a $20 bill. He says, you give this to my friend Dick Lugar. So I get to the fundraiser, and then everyone kind of mills around, then Lugar speaks. And then I went to, I think it was Emily Kruger, who was his campaign director. And I said, can I speak for like 30 seconds because after the senator, because I think this is important, and I promise it's not, and doesn't have a damn thing to do about me. And she goes, okay, sure. So after the senator was done speaking, she says, Robert has something he'd like to give to you, Senator. And I said, I just left Andy Jacobs' house. And he wanted me to give this to you. And I pulled this brand new $20 bill out of my pocket and I gave it to Senator Lugar. And he welled up. And that's the kind of thing. And he goes, I have the utmost respect and admiration for Andy Jacobs. Mm-hmm. And he goes, please thank him for me for this. And it was kind of those weird moments in time where I just happened to be a conduit. And it was more than the perfunctory thank my friend. You could tell that there was a relationship there where they had worked together many, many times. Is that something Lieutenant Governor Mutz and Senator Mayhern, we're here with Veteran Strategies, Leaders and Legends. Is that something that happened a lot back then where you saw that sort of real closeness, not some sort of made up closeness for the media or for public consumption?
Well, Andy, who lost to Bill Hudnut in 72 and then came back and defeated Hudnut in 74. And then later on, they became personal friends.
Jacobs told me that one of the debates they rode together. Oh, they rode in the car together. Either Jacobs picked up Hudnut or Hudnut picked up Jacobs.
I don't know about that, but I do know that when they both became older and were ill, that their two wives were very close, talked on a regular basis. And I remember calling Bill Hudnut just before he died. And his wife told me, well, I was back in Indianapolis to see Kim. Kim, that's right. Kim Jacobs. Yeah, right. That's it. Yeah. And so yes, the two of them had the utmost respect for each other. And I think they genuinely liked each other. See, that's Louis and my situation, too. It isn't that we just think it's nice to be
right.
reaching across the aisle and so we can tell people that. But we genuinely like each other, and we've done things together that are a little unusual.
Yeah. And that was the point of the question was, you know, you can mug for the cameras and then show up at the you know, Catholic festival together and shake hands and backslap for a couple minutes. But I got the sense from talking to Congressman Jacobs, but it was just deeper. I mean, some of the language he used to describe his relationship with President H.W. Bush, I mean, it was almost reverent. Like, I wouldn't. He wasn't a guy that I thought was, you know, I would have voted for president or whatever. But as far as just how he felt about him personally, I think that is something that is missing from today. Yeah. Or am I, John, do I have that wrong?
No, I think you're right. Now, I will say this, that there are still some friendships that crop up. You don't see very many of them between across the aisle, that is Democrat, Republican. One of the things we've been trying to do recently, there's an association of retired legislators in Indiana now. And this group has raised some money and has created an award for legislators from both parties who have demonstrated the ability to work in a common way about a common problem. And I think if you go to the chambers today, you'll find the plaques that are on the wall. And I think they have two groups of awardees, and they pick a Democrat and a Republican for each house for a session and make the award. Now, sometimes there aren't any, so you can't do it.
Blank.
Yeah, but it's one of those things. They asked me to come and speak at the award ceremony. They held it in the Supreme Court chamber, and there were some expressions that I think were quite genuine in that situation.
You know, I think that what people lose sight of, and I think it's going on in the U.S. Congress right now, particularly in the U.S. House, that legislators have two constituencies. They have the constituency that elected them and that will vote on them in 2 or 4 or 6 years. And then the other constituency are the other members of the body, the fellow representatives or senators. And you have to get along with both of those constituencies if you want to get anything done. You know, it's nice being a state senator. You know, the lobbyists laugh at your jokes and the doorkeeper opens the door for you and everything like that. But it's not that wonderful. Being a member of the U.S. House or a U.S. Senate, it's the same thing. I mean, you know, they're not that wonderful just to hold them, just to be holding them. So you want somebody who wants to get something done, and the kind of attitudes that manifest themselves here of late in the last several years in the House and in the Senate, U.S. House and Senate, it's as though they've lost sight of the fact that your second constituency are the other members that you have to get along with.
You know, I think you're right, Louis. And one of the things that has made it difficult to become good friends with other people besides your own caucus members is the fact that the pressure, particularly in the U.S. House, is to the minute you get elected is to start raising money again for the next campaign. And as a matter of fact, the majority leaders or the caucus chairman, whoever is running the various chambers, have an arrangement now in which they say to their members, we expect you to spend a certain number of hours a week calling potential contributors.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and so the result of this whole thing is that the pressure on raising money is so high, and the reason the way they do that, of course, they say what you raise, we will match with money we get someplace else. And so it's not a good situation. There isn't a lot of time, frankly, I think, in the U.S. House. Now, I don't know about the Senate. I can't answer that one.
Is there a particular person that you, for each of you, we're here with former Lieutenant Governor John Mutz, former State Senator Louis Mahern, Veteran Strategies presenting the podcast Leaders and Legends. Is there a particular person each one of you looked up to in your time in public office, either before you got there or as you were trying to rise, Louis?
You know, my family's been involved, particularly on my mother's side, been involved in politics for quite a while. I had an uncle, Paul Cantwell, who served on the city county council, and he served a term in the Indiana House of Representatives. His mother, my maternal grandmother, Edith Cantwell, was a Democratic precinct committeeman in Beech Grove in 1932 when Franklin Roosevelt was elected the first time. As a matter of fact, I have a form letter at home from Franklin Roosevelt in the envelope, and the return address is the Biltmore Hotel, which is where his headquarters was in 1932, and thanking her for her service as a precinct committeeman and that sort of thing. She was a precinct committeeman all the way up until about 1946, I think. So, you know, I've had that kind of background in politics, and you know, when I would be around my family members who were in politics, and I had occasion to meet people who were involved in the Democratic Party, precinct committeemen, they were a ward chairman or something like that. This is when I'm a teenager. I thought that these were very interesting people. These people had stories to tell and things that they cared about, and they just seemed more interesting. And
your brother served in the Indiana House as well?
My brother Ed served in the Indiana House, yeah. But I told my mother when I was 11 that I wanted to be a politician.
I remember asking someone you would know, and anyone who's been involved in Indiana politics last 20, 30 years ago, 20 years would know. Miss Katie Mullen, who worked at voter registration for years and years and years. I asked her one time, ardent Democrat from an ardent Democrat family. I'm like, did you ever vote for Republican? She goes, no. I said, would you ever vote for Republican? She goes, never. I said, would you have voted for any Republican in history? She goes, absolutely not. I go, Lincoln? She goes, never. And I just was like, I gave her a big hug. I'm like, I get it. I understand your loyalty. It was amazing how back then with the party system and the machine system, those loyalty demands seemed to be so strong. Is that something the both of you experienced as you were growing up, that not growing up, but growing up in politics per se, that there was a pressure to be loyal 100% of the time and toe the line and not necessarily reach out and be quote unquote weakened by a friendship from the other side of the aisle?
One thing I'd say about the issue you're raising there, an awful lot of people today are too young to know that the political party system and the patronage system, as it used to exist, was one of the ways that people from minority communities found themselves on the way up to power. If you had a neighborhood on the South Side, my mother-in-law was what they called WI, West Indianapolis. And people in that neighborhood found their ability to be heard by telling party leaders, we can produce a vote majority for it. We can do this or that. And they, in turn, had loyalty to each other. And that's one of the things that's pretty much forgotten now, it seems. You know, we had enclaves of Irish people. I can't name them all now. Louis knows them better than I do. But the point I'm getting at is that these people came to the United States very poor, with very little influence, no leverage in politics or anything else. And the party system was one of the things available to them. And that's something that's largely been, I think, forgotten.
Louis?
Yeah, well, one of the reasons why the Irish are so stereotypically involved in politics was that when when the immigrants came here, and there was a huge flood of Irish that came here in the 1840s, late 1840s, because of the famine. But when they came, when the various immigrant groups came here, the Irish were the just about the only ones who came here speaking English when they got off the boat. Right. And since since our system was based on the British system, they understood the system and how it worked. They understood representative government. And so the Irish were sort of the intermediary between the establishment and the government and these other immigrant groups.
This should probably be the point where I mention on Leaders and Legends that I've met Senator Mayhern about a half dozen times, each time at the Golden Ace, the magnificent McGinley Bar on the east side run by one of the great families of this city. And
well, you know, Kathleen Mullen's mother,
that's right,
was a McGinley. And they, the, my family, I'm the oldest of 10 kids, and we grew up on Kelly Street, south of Fountain Square. And just down the street, there were the Cunninghams, and there were 10 of them. And Kathleen Cunningham was one of the older ones. And as a matter of fact, Kathleen Cunningham babysat me and my some of my younger siblings when my parents, you know, would go out on a date. We'd go out. And when I ran for mayor, I told this story until Kathleen Mullen was in the audience, and she came up to me afterwards, and she said, would you please not tell that story anymore about how I was your babysitter?
Yeah.
We mentioned something. You guys both mentioned someone earlier, and I'm going to get to him because then I want to talk a little bit about Indianapolis before we end the podcast. I never met him. I shook his hand one time, but I've heard other people talk very admiringly of Governor Orr. What was he like, John?
Well, you know, Bob and I knew each other well because we both served in the state Senate together. And when you live in the Senate for a period of time and you work there a while, you get to know the people pretty well. You get to know who to trust and who has the real knowledge on specific questions. But I had no idea how much closer I would become to Bob until we served as governor and lieutenant governor. He was a genuine gentleman in every respect. He, of course, is one of the last of the greatest generation. He served in the Japanese theater, whatever the right name of it was, during the Second World War. I remember so well Bob and I walking up to the headquarters of Fuji Heavy Industries in Japan. That's the company that owns Subaru in Lafayette. And Bob said, I can't believe I'm going up here, hat in hand, begging these people to invest in Indiana. And it wasn't many years ago that we waged war on each other. And as we did that, we walked by a Japanese Zero that was mounted on a big concrete platform. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the Japanese Zero was the dominant plane that the Japanese used. We later came back with the Mustang and several others. And it was a sudden moment for me to recognize that here's a guy who had been able to turn himself from the hate that this country had for Japan during the war, and it was there.
Absolutely.
And suddenly here he was now in a very different role, and he was just a wonderful guy to be with. I don't think there is any lieutenant governor in the history of the United States. Now I sound like Trump. I shouldn't be talking like that, but I don't think there was any that had a better relationship with the governor than I did.
And do you know much about what, and Bob Orr was served as lieutenant governor for 8 years under Governor Otis Bowen. What was their relationship like? Did he learn from that? Or?
Yes, he learned from that. He and Doc were not that close. Doc was not close really to anyone in a lot of ways. He had a remarkable memory. If you voted against his bill, he remembered 20 years later, all that kind of stuff.
Isn't that called Irish Alzheimer's, Mr. Mayhern?
You forget everything but the grudges.
Yeah. At any rate, They had a good relationship. I shouldn't say it was a nasty one, nothing like that, but not like what Bob and I had. He invited me on a regular basis to come to the residence, and we'd sit and have a beer in front of the fireplace, and we'd talk about what we were working on and so forth, and we'd discuss who was for us and who was against us on this issue or that issue. And it was a remarkable kind of period of my life.
One thing I want to ask you about also is you both probably knew two very popular, very victorious, very impactful leaders when they were kids, or at least young folks. What was it like to see Evan Bayh become governor and senator? And what was it like to see Mitch Daniels become governor and now president of Purdue University? Louis, go ahead. You probably knew them when they were just either in their teens or early 20s, or in Evan's case, probably just a young kid.
Yeah, well, I'm remembering that Evan was maybe 15 or 16 years old when I was on Birch's staff. I didn't see him around very much. When he came back here after he was out of law school, he was making some noise about being interested in running for office. I approached him. I and a couple of other people approached him about running for the state senate in Terre Haute, and he thanked us but said no, that he wasn't interested in doing that. And then he ultimately ran for Secretary of State in, I guess it was 86.
86, correct.
I saw him coming up. He was obviously very bright. He enjoyed a lot of popularity, I think, because of his father.
And the by name was magic. At the time was just
because
magical.
Because of his father's work. But I will tell you that I knew Mitch when he was on Lugar's staff, and because the members of the General Assembly would go out like once a year, something like that, to D.C. and lobby Congress on various matters. And then he came back here and he was working at Lilly's, and I was hanging around with Mark Lebbers, and Lebbers and I and Mitch went down to Cincinnati for a ball game down there, and I think Mitch Daniels is quite possibly the best governor Indiana has had in my political lifetime. I voted for Mitch the second time he ran. You know, I raised $50,000 for Joe Kernan when Mitch ran the first time, and when Mitch ran for re-election, I voted for him.
I'd like to say something about Mitch in a little different way. My introduction to Mitch was from his mother and father. They were deeply involved in Republican politics as volunteers. They didn't run for office, but Dottie Daniels, you knew. She was at every women's event and all that kind of thing. But I really got to know him when he went to work for Keith Bulin. Keith Bulin had a business affiliated with his party chairmanship called Campaign Communicators. And his major employee was Mitch. Okay, we're now in a primary election season, and I'm being challenged by Dan Burton for a Senate seat.
Oh, okay.
And we were, through reapportionment, we were put in the same district. And I don't think he was in the Senate the term just before. He'd been in the House. Dan had become famous in Marion County for his anti-busing stance. He organized rallies all over the county and got a lot of personal attention. So Keith Bulin said to me, John, he says, you got a tough primary. I'm going to ask Mitch to work on your campaign. And so, in essence, Mitch Daniels, along with my wife, managed my campaign against Dan Burton. And he did it largely from campaign communicators' perspective. But he was deeply involved in that. we did a poll. I can't tell you that it was a really professional poll, but it was a poll. And it showed Burton ahead of me 3-1, 2 months out from that campaign. We won 3-2. And I have to give Mitch a good deal of the credit for the way we went about it.
He does seem to be, and I know he once told me I had moxie, which I thought was probably the greatest compliment I'll ever get in my life. But he does seem to be particularly politically astute. I guess genius probably isn't too strong a term. He just seems to know the right. I was communications director for the Indiana Republican Party in 2006 and 2007, and probably the nadir of his two terms as governor. But there was just always a sense that he had it all figured out ahead of everybody else, and it's just going to be okay. And then in 2008, obviously, he carries Marion County by about 14,000 votes when Barack Obama carried it by about 130,000 votes. So that tells you a little bit about the comeback he had. Is it, when you see these younger folks come on and they run and they win, is there like a special pride? Like you feel like this kid already had it, whether it was Evan Bayh or Mitch Daniels or somebody else, where it's like, this isn't surprising to me. Well, or was it surprising that they decided to run as opposed to just be behind the scenes?
Well, in the case of Mitch, for a long time, I didn't think he'd ever run for office himself. And as you probably know, he and Sherry had disagreements over how much of his life he could devote to politics, et cetera.
And isn't it true that he was offered the Senate seat in 1988 that Quayle vacated?
There was a lot of discussion, and Lugar was deeply involved in that discussion. But that's historic now.
Sure.
And so Mitch did decide to run. And I remember him calling me for money the first day. and he said, you know what I'm doing? I'm giving up an opportunity to make, and he used a figure, X number of dollars a year so that I can run for office. And he says, so I want you to help pay for this. And so I did.
And did it work?
Oh, well, yeah. Well, see, of course, you can tell from what I've already said about him that he was a very good choice, a good candidate. It's hard for me to know the best governor of the history that I was alive. Ed Ziegler, an old-time political writer, said Harold Handley should be in that category. I didn't know Harold Handley just as a name,
sure,
as a kid. But I would have to say that Mitch was a great governor. I wanted him to run for president. Now, Mitch probably would have had a tough time winning that kind of a campaign. But it seemed to me that if you got a guy like this on the stump and he had a chance to demonstrate his ability to describe the issues, the pros and cons of the issues and so forth, that would be an extremely useful service to this country.
As a political communicator, and halfway is how I make my living as a communicator, I don't know that anyone's better than Mitch Daniels. I think he said, and please correct me, Governor, if you're listening, please correct me, that he thought he could win the nomination, but he would have lost to Obama in 12. I think that's his quote. And I want to ask you about this one last thing, and then we move on. I ran into John Gregg a few months after he lost the election in 16 to Holcomb. And we had a quick conversation, a couple of minutes, right on the street downtown. And I asked him, I said, did Pence give you a call? And Gregg said, yes, he did. He said, like he called the Thursday after the election. So Pence is elected vice president. Gregg loses to Holcomb. And he said, yes. He goes, Mike called me and was very gracious and very kind about the election result and just asked if I needed anything and if I was okay. Without dwelling, of course, each of you have suffered high profile losses for big races. Did you call each other? Did you say, Louie, I'm sorry you lost to Steve Goldsmith in 91? Or Louie, did you call John and go, you know, I'm really sorry you lost in 88?
Yeah, we really didn't call each other. We did empathize with each other, however, and I can tell you that as time went along. You mentioned John Gregg. John came and wanted to have lunch with me before he decided to run the second time for governor. And he said, should I do it? And I said, well, John, of course, I can't judge this far out. But yes, I think you'd be a good governor of Indiana. And frankly, I still would say that about John. And the conversation went further, and he said, well, you wouldn't support me, would you? And I said, no, I couldn't do that. My party affiliation and loyalty and history, I just wouldn't make sense. And so there was a kind of understanding there, and I thought he would win that election. Of course, what happened was the Trump phenomenon.
Sure.
I mean, we wouldn't have elected a Republican governor. We wouldn't have elected a Republican senator. All those elections hinged on the Trump margin in Indiana.
About 2 or 3 weeks before the election in 16, I saw Jim Adderholt, who was chief of staff, former state rep, friend, to both of you. Sure. And I asked him, because Holcomb is my contemporary, Governor Holcomb's my contemporary, and I agree with you. I think John Gregg would have been and would be a good governor. Uh-huh. But obviously, I'm Team Holcomb.
Sure.
And I said, well, what's going to happen? And Adderholt, who was certainly involved, said, Trump wins by 10 points, we win the governorship. Trump wins by fewer than 10 points, we lose. It's that simple. It's either him, he's the dispositive factor, win or lose. Louis, you ran for mayor in 91. Is it a situation where you can't expect your Republican friends to support you, even though they think you would do a good job? How do you square that circle?
In Indiana, you only have to put a name to a political contribution if it's $100 or more, or maybe above $100. I can't remember which. And I will tell you that that I had at least 4 or 5 Republican office holders who gave me $99.
Let's talk just for a few minutes before we wrap up about Indianapolis. You're listening to the Leaders and Legends podcast presented by Veteran Strategies. We're here with former Lieutenant Governor John Mutz, former State Senator Louis Mahern, great friends. We're very grateful to have you on today. What about Indianapolis in 2019 would have been most surprising to each of you in Indianapolis of 1969? If I were to say this, point to this building, or say we hosted this event, or we have this reputation, which of any of those facts about modern Indianapolis, 21st century of Indianapolis, which would you find like, wow, I never would have predicted that? Louis, go ahead.
I don't know that I could single out one. I will tell you, I think, which is much more interesting and important about downtown Indianapolis and Indianapolis as a whole. When I had been in the legislature for, I think, maybe 4 years, something like that, 2 years, I got a call from Jim Morris, who wanted to invite me to come to have breakfast with a group of other males, other guys that were involved in politics, Democrat and Republican. And John was one of them. And there was also some people, Herb Simon. There were people from the HUDnut administration, Bob Kennedy, and then Bill Crawford. There were about 14, 15 people, who came up with the name. I guess it was maybe, Morris who came up with this name of the city committee. And we would have breakfast about once a month. Morris was with the endowment at the time. And
the Lilly Endowment.
The Lilly Endowment. And he would bring in speakers, people to sit down with us, have breakfast and talk about, what makes a great city and that sort of thing. And out of that came one of the very first early things was, bricks on the circle. And
really?
Yeah, to put these bricks and to fix up the Monument Circle. It was kind of getting a little ragged around the edges and everything, and to restore the circle. And so, you know, they were very careful to include legislators on in that because they had to have legislators, you know. The Dome Stadium came out of meetings we had, that the city committee had. Don't forget that when we built the Dome Stadium, we didn't have a franchise.
Correct.
And White River State Park came out of that committee of people sitting down and sort of dreaming. I never imagined. I mean, I knew that, you know, we had some oomph in that room, and we ought to be able to get some things done, passing tax increases and that sort of thing. But I never imagined that it would have the kind of impact that it had, particularly in the number of young people who wanted to move downtown. And I mean, that I think is probably what is I find most gratifying is that. And I will tell you, when I was first elected to the Senate, and it's 1977, 1978, Ed Tracy, friend, very good friend of mine, we were high school classmates and everything. He and I and our wives used to take the train maybe twice a year or something like that up to Chicago and spend the weekend up there and then go up on Friday afternoon and come back on Sunday afternoon. When we would come back on Sunday afternoon, there was no place to eat dinner in downtown Indianapolis. There was no place that we get off the train. You know, we had to go home. Because there weren't any restaurants in downtown Indianapolis open on Sunday afternoon.
And that's one of the reasons for the and to get Lieutenant Governor's comments. But I've asked that of the people who've been on the podcast so far are kind of in the same situation. They came, you know, they either grew up here or worked here for the last 40 or 50 years. And they tell the same story. Like, you really can't understand how just flat out languid and flaccid and boring downtown Indianapolis was 50 years ago, 45, 40 years ago. Lieutenant Governor, what would that be for you?
I guess the best way to say that is that the vitality of downtown and that area would be the biggest difference. You ask, what would the big difference be? And of course, that includes crowds in downtown Indianapolis. It includes Super Bowls. It includes just the myriad of activities. But I think Louis mentioned the city committee. We were a group of individuals who largely were considered, quote, on our way up in a way. Yeah. You know, they were guys from Lilly and they were guys from
the second tier.
That's right. And we were kind of second tier. Now, I wouldn't say Herb Simon was second tier, but you know. But at any rate, I think the point I make is that we wanted to see Indianapolis be a heck of a lot better. So we voluntarily paid our own way to visit other cities. And we went to six or seven that I can think of. Atlanta was one. We went to Ottawa.
Toronto?
Toronto in Canada. We took a look at the things that were going on in these cities and then decided whether these are things we wanted to support and make a commitment to.
And it's interesting because other cities are doing that to Indianapolis now.
There's
an article in the IBJ about the Sports Corp, and we interviewed Ryan Vaughn, the head of the Sports Corp. Yeah. He was talking about that up-and-coming cities now are looking at us like, okay, how did Indianapolis do it?
Yeah, that's right. And the city committee always comes up as one of the major factors. Now, what I want to point out is that during the time we were meeting, it was never publicized that we were meeting. We didn't have any minutes. We didn't keep records, but we voluntarily got together because we cared. And the other thing was, it was great fun. I mean, we had a great time doing all these things. And I guess what I'm really saying about this is that kind of spirit started originally, I like to think, with two political movements. One was the Action Committee in the Republican Party, and the other one was the Young Turks, who were the Jim Beatty reformers when he was the Democratic county chairman. And Jim and his colleagues had a vision not too dissimilar from ours. I mean, In fact, they would have unified the government in Marion County, like Unigov, but they would have done it in a different way. They wouldn't have done it so that we had a majority for a long period of time.
You know, P. Yeah. McAllister said that to me, the legendary philanthropist and industrialist and civic leader.
He was part of that movement.
Well, he said that when he was president of the Capital Improvement Board, he said, nobody ever mentioned politics. He goes, like, seriously, the Republicans didn't say we can't do that, that helps Democrats, and the Democrats can't say we can't do that, that helps Republicans. He goes, we did all these things, and he was president of the Capital Improvement Board when the Colts came, when the Hoosier Dome was built. He says that never came up. It was all about Indianapolis, and I don't think that's entirely gone away. I mean, what Greg Ballard did and tried to do isn't that much different than what Bart Peterson tried to do, and so I think that spirit is still there. I want to ask particularly you, Lieutenant Governor Mutz, before we go to our last questions. I have said this. I said this at lunch earlier today, and please correct me if I'm wrong, because I brag on you on this all the time. So correct. Here's your chance to say that I'm wrong. I've called you the most unsung leader in the history of Indianapolis, because I keep hearing from people who were around that time, whether it's P.E. McAllister or Jim Morris, how crucial you were towards the growth of education in this city. How big a role did you play, or did you play a role, in what has become the modern IUPUI?
Yeah. Well, yes, I was. I tell you, I'm one of these guys who's lived long enough to have been present for a number of movements and changes. And I had not always been a leader of the movement, maybe a member of the committee that did the movement or was responsible for it, but I was around for the creation of Unigov. I helped write the bill, get it passed. Then I had a chance to be part of the city committee. And, of course, one of the things that came up at the famous meeting at John Burkhart's house was the meeting was held originally to create a university in Indianapolis. And our goal was to have a state-supported new institution in Indianapolis. We said you can't be a great city without a great public university. Well, at that same meeting, there were 10 of us there, somehow or another we started talking about unified government, and we said, well, let's do that too. and so that's what happened.
What the hell?
And what I'm trying to say to you is I appreciate your comment, but I'm just lucky that I've been present all during this time period, and in many cases active in getting them done. And so,
Lily, would you say that Mr. Mutz is being a bit modest? I think he's being a bit modest based on how other people I know of that generation talk about his contribution to this city.
Well, he's being especially modest relative to the way most elected officials. I shouldn't say most elected official. Some elected officials.
Yeah.
There are people in this business, I'm sorry to say, are full of themselves. I've never experienced that with John.
We come to the end of the podcast. It's the five questions. We ask the same five questions of every guest. And so of every guest or guest in this case. So we're going to start with Senator Mahern, so I'll ask you, then we'll get an answer from John, and then we'll go forward. So, first question, what was the first job you had?
I was a caddy at Meridian Hills, and my family moved off the south side in April of 1957. I was just finishing my sophomore year at Cathedral, and we had to move to the north side. Because we needed a bigger house, and
for all those kids,
and they had bigger homes over in Garfield Park, but my dad couldn't afford one of those, and so we moved to 42nd and Broadway, and my dad could afford that house because it was a changing neighborhood.
Well, my first real job in which I got a salary and got paid, I was a copy editor and member of the copy desk at the Indianapolis News. And I did this while I was still in college. And I got paid $1.10 an hour for that job.
Did it did you meet the Pulliams at the time? I mean, was it?
Oh, yeah. You have to understand, back in those days, Gene Pulliam was the managing editor of the news. He was on the scene every day. And if you made a mistake, he knew about it and he talked to you. You know. So I have to tell you, I don't want to belabor this, but a copy editor at that time, one of their jobs was to take the wire services that came in from the three major wires, or AP, UP, and INS, and take the stories on the same subject, put them in a pile, and give them to a writer. And then they would do a story, which was a compilation of the three wire services. Well, one day I clipped a very important story and put it on the desk of an individual who I thought was going to make the story or write the story. Well, it happened that guy was off that day. And what happened was that the news didn't have a story on that subject, but the Indianapolis Times, which was the other afternoon newspaper, did. And you thought a bomb had gone off in that city room. Gene said, "What the hell happened? How did we miss the story?" You know, and of course, it was my fault. So that was my first job.
What was your first concert, Louis? First concert you ever went to?
You know, I have to fess up that I've probably only been to 3 or 4 concerts in my life. I was never, I mean, I listened to rock and roll and all that sort of stuff on the radio, but I have no idea. I just, you know, music, it's kind of interesting because music has never been an important part of my life. I mean, I enjoy it, but
you wouldn't call yourself a huge fan of it like a lot of people are.
Well, that's right. That's right. I mean, you know, if some of my siblings and I participated in a charity fundraising trivia contest not too long ago, and we had to recruit some people who were under 40 because the last thing I remember is Rolling Stones, you know.
Well, John, what was your first concert?
First concert, I was in the third grade, and Fabian Savitsky, who was longtime concert master of the Indianapolis Symphony, regularly held concerts for school children in the old Cato Tabernacle. Now, the old Cato Tabernacle has been long since gone in Indianapolis, and they bussed in school kids from grade schools all over Indianapolis, and they had a chance to listen to genuine symphony music. And I remember Fabian Savitsky said, and he was a big, mean-looking man, and he said, "We have two rules today. One is you do not talk while the orchestra is playing, and two is you do not move from your seat while you are here." And that my first concert. I went home, told my mother, and she said, "Well, that's wonderful. Would you like to go to a real symphony? Concert, you know, and I said, "Yeah." And so that year I actually went, and I was able not to talk during the symphony and stay in my seat.
I got a feeling we're not going to have that answer duplicated in any future podcasts. Louis, if you could recommend any book, which book would you recommend?
I would recommend a book called The Brothers, written by a guy by the name of Kinzer. And it's the story of in the mid 1950s, when the Secretary of State of the United States and the Director of the CIA were brothers, and
John Foster Dulles and Allen Dulles,
mm-hmm. and about the their policies and the actions that they took during their time in office, and how we pay for those policies yet today.
John?
I'm going to kind of throw you a surprise, and it's the Samuel Adams book. And the reason I cite that is that he obviously wasn't president. He was the son of a president. And in that book, he describes his father's visits to Europe. Now, this was a time period in which the United States was not the leader of the free world. Yeah.
When John Adams was sent overseas after independence had been won in 1783.
That is exactly right. Mm-hmm. And that book is an amazing insight into not just a father and son, but also into how Europe played out a role in the United States. You know, in that, you begin to get a real understanding of how important France was in the history of the United States. I doubt if many people think much about that. I don't remember ever being taught that in grade school, but I doubt if we'd be here if France hadn't intervened.
Certainly, Yorktown, where all the American uniforms were paid for by the French, and the fleet was French, mm-hmm. and the vast, you know, huge contingent of French soldiers, the Battle of Yorktown, where the British surrendered and basically ended the war. Number four, if you could witness any event in history, Louis, which event would you choose? Be in the room, be on the field, be in the plane, see it with your own eyes.
I would probably say the flag raising at Mount Suribachi.
Iwo Jima, February of 45.
Yeah, February or April, something like
April
that.
April is Okinawa and February is...
Yeah.
To be there on Iwo Jima when they raised the flag on Mount Suribachi, famous...
Just to see it.
We should note that, State Senator Mahern is a proud Marine. Yeah. So I can see that. I can see that. John?
Well, you know, I have to confess to you that I'm one of these people who still gets a tear in his eyes when I stand for the Star Spangled Banner. For some reason or another, it still has an enormous emotional tug on me. Started during the Second World War, and I guess if I had an opportunity, I know this may sound funny, I would like to have witnessed the ceremony in Japan where Japan ended the Second World War, their part of it, and agreed to surrender.
So September of 45 on the USS Missouri, MacArthur.
Yeah, and I remember seeing the pictures of that and so forth. Yeah, that's an event that would have been an unbelievable thing to see.
Is that what Greg Ballard chose the same thing?
He did.
Another proud Marine.
Yeah.
Last question. If you could have dinner with anyone in the world right now, Louis, who would you choose? No, and no family members. We've decided to exclude family members. Just a couple of hours off the record, hanging out at dinner.
Anybody?
Tracy will be mad if you don't choose him.
I can have Tracy. I can have dinner with Tracy anytime I want.
Yeah, I was going to say, is that rare?
There's an awful lot going on in Europe right now. I think Angela Merkel would be a very interesting person.
Chancellor of Germany.
The Chancellor of Germany. And the sort of the outgoing leader of the European Union. I think she is anybody who follows those events would have to concede that she has been the leader for the last 10 or 14 years, something like that.
Stabilizing influence.
Yeah, absolutely. Agreed. Absolutely. And stood up for human decency when these populist movements were barking at her and her party. And stood up for the rational protection of immigrants.
Good.
I'm going to throw you another sideline curve, I guess. Is Henry Kissinger still alive?
He is still alive.
He is.
Well, that's the guy I'd choose. Now, why would I choose him? It's because I'd like, assuming his memory is still good, which I don't know, I would like to hear his take on the historic events that he participated in, his relationship with Richard Nixon, his involvement in a whole variety of other things. And the reason I say this is I met him once when he came to speak in Indianapolis at a big Republican fundraiser. And it was, believe it or not, I can't believe it, but it was held at the state fairgrounds, hardly prestigious location.
Hardly Kissinger-esque.
Yeah, and as I think, I want to say it's in the cattle barn, but it wasn't that bad. But it was at the state fairgrounds. And for some reason, I was one of a group of young people who were assigned to greet him and all that sort of thing. I had a chance to talk to him, and I've always been entranced by the guy. He was one of those people who seemingly had an insight that was a little more in depth than most people.
Well, he certainly, I mean, to your point about Chancellor Merkel, I mean, talk about present at the creation. I mean, he seems to be someone who, it's a two-sided coin. There are a lot of people who credit him with a lot of the detente in the early 70s, and then a lot of people who really question his methods and his Machiavellian sort of way of looking at things.
Well, some people also give him a lot of credit for Nixon's trip to China. You know, mm-hmm.
Correct.
The opening up of the relationship with China. That was a big deal.
He does seem to personify the fact that deviousness and brilliance can go hand in hand.
Well, there's something else he personifies. You remember later in his life, he married a much younger woman.
Nancy. Is it Nancy?
Yeah, Nancy somebody, yeah. And they ask him, how do you account for that? He says, power is the ultimate aphrodisiac.
That is a perfect way to end this podcast. We are absolutely thrilled to have both of you come here. Former Lieutenant Governor John Mutz, former State Senator Louis Mahern, good friends. You've been very gracious with your time. We cannot say enough for how much you've done for this city, for your fellow Hoosiers. You've been listening to Leaders and Legends podcast presented by Veteran Strategies. My name is Robert Vane, and thank you very much for listening. And if you see Senator Mahern or you see Lieutenant Governor Mutz at any time in your lives from now on, extend your hand and tell them thank you. Thank you very much for listening to Leaders and Legends, brought to you by Veteran Strategies Incorporated. If you want to contact us about this program or our menu of public relations services, please send us an email at robert@veteranstrategies.com. That's robert@veteranstrategies.com.